It's the Morning Show. I'm Shireen Siewert. Diversity, equity, and inclusion programs have expanded in recent years at universities around the country, but not everyone is embracing that trend. In Wisconsin's state legislature, the UW's DEI programs have become a political flashpoint. What are your thoughts? Are these necessary, and how should they be funded? Join in, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Megan Zanies is a senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Megan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
So Republicans in Wisconsin State Assembly are really pushing to cut funding for the state's colleges over the system's diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI, efforts. What is it that has led Wisconsin to this point?
Yeah, so right now, we're at a bit of a stalemate. Robin Ross last week made his stance on this very clear. He said he wants to cut $32 million that the university system would use for DEI efforts. He said that he feels they should redirect it to something that's, quote, more productive and more broadly supported. So last week, after he said that, the budget committee actually postponed or delayed a vote about this. After Ross's comments, some opposition from prominent Democrats, including Governor Evers, came out. Governor threatened to veto the entire state budget if that $32 million cut were part of it. Ross came back and said the cuts could become even bigger. So that's kind of where we are, that's gotten us to this point.
And it sounds like this fight over DEI funding is threatening to stall the entire state budget plan. As you said, there's, you know, these differences in opinions. In other states, how large of an issue is this?
We actually haven't seen this come out particularly in a state budget, other than in Wisconsin. But at the Chronicle, we're actually tracking bills that have come out of state legislatures that do target DEI in some way or another. And I can talk about a little bit about what those are. But there are 38 bills that we're tracking in 21 states. Five of them have been signed by governors. 26 of them have been tabled somewhere across the way. And that's, again, since the beginning of this year.
We're talking about the push from Republicans against diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives in colleges in Wisconsin and beyond with Megan Zanies. She is a senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Your Chronicle of Higher Education tracks anti-DEI legislation in America, as you said. So what are some of the examples of the different types of anti-DEI initiatives? They don't all look the same.
That's right, they don't. And so there are one of generally four different ways that this legislation can target DEI work. It's a combination of one or more of these. But the four are that they would prohibit colleges from having DEI offices, staff, or programming, that they would ban mandatory diversity training, they would block colleges from using diversity statements in hiring, admissions, or promotion, and that they would ban race, sex, and other factors from being used in those same three departments, admissions, hiring, and promotion. So those are the four. And a lot of this legislation from state to state is based off a model that we've seen two conservative think tanks, the Manhattan and the Goldwater Institutes, propose earlier this year. So those are all sort of taking their cues from this model legislation.
So really, this all came from two think tanks. I mean, how did it all start? How did we get here?
Well, there's been, an increased attention to diversity in various forms in higher education and certainly beyond in K-12. We've seen similar attacks and book bans, things like that, legislative attention to DEI. And so I think these think tanks certainly provided a blueprint, some language for legislators to go off of, but it's certainly not the first that we've heard or the first that this has been contested in any of these states.
Megan, I just have to wonder if we think back, I don't know, a few years ago and, you know, roll back the clock, and DEI initiatives were growing. People were talking about them as being a positive thing for universities. And then everything changed. So what are some of the arguments against DEI initiatives? Why are some groups so opposed to these things?
Well, to be clear, a lot of people are still in favor of them, including a lot of faculty members and folks at universities that do oppose this legislation. But the basic argument that it puts forward and that the Republicans in Wisconsin are putting forward is that this is a threat to academic freedom, first and foremost. They feel that using taxpayer money on DEI work is a waste of that money. And ultimately, there's concern that liberal professors or DEI officers in programming are, quote, indoctrinating students.
And what is the response to that then? I mean, what do DEI proponents say when they hear these things like, hey, we're, you know, this is a potentially indoctrinating students? What's the pushback then?
They say, no, we're not indoctrinating students. Faculty members and DEI officers say that this is their jobs, that by and large students actually do want and appreciate having these things. They feel that they're not indoctrinating, that it's an important part of the college experience, of a lot of students' sense of belonging in some cases based on their identities, and that they simply don't feel like a lot of the attacks have any credence.
Do you have any sense of what the general public opinion is about this issue? And it seems like there's a stark divide. We have, you know, one group that says DEI is absolutely necessary, another group that says it is absolutely unnecessary, it could be even harmful. I mean, what does the general public think? Do we know?
I think that's still sort of hard to say. There is, from what I see, a sense that the general public is divided in largely the same way that we're seeing, you know, roughly along political lines, that some folks on the right side of the aisle feel that DEI is not necessary, and a lot of people that do tend to be more liberal or democratic will say, yes, we do feel like this is important in society at large and in higher ed. So it's fairly well divided.
Megan Zanies is a senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. She writes about research universities and workplace issues. You can join in on this conversation with your thoughts, your questions. 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward. We're talking with Megan Zanies, senior reporter with the Chronicle of Higher Education, about the political pushback against DEI efforts in the UW system and elsewhere around the country. What are your thoughts about these programs? Megan Zanies is a senior reporter, and she stays with us. You can call in 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Plenty of time to take those calls, and we do have a call now from Andrew in Palmyra. Hi, Andrew. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
So my comment would be that these DEI initiatives tend to be more left-leaning in ideology, and like things such as the policies on Twitter, it'll put a chilling effect on anybody who has a conservative outlook or a conservative perspective, and it'll silence those perspectives. So I would say that these sorts of initiatives don't have any place in college campuses where people are supposed to be going to have, you know, new ideas introduced to them, and there may be their ideological framework of the world challenged.
Thanks for sharing that perspective, Andrew. And Megan, what do you say to that? I mean, that's you know, that argument that we hear frequently.
Yeah, certainly that term chilling effect has been used by folks actually on both sides of this who feel that on the left that these efforts to curb DEI does chill their work. There have been folks like Andrew who feel that the existing framework does sort of chill conservative opinion. And there's actually a little bit of evidence in a recent survey that the UW system put out that suggests that more conservative students reported having felt pressured by an instructor to agree with a specific political or ideological view that was being expressed in class. And we could talk a little bit more about that survey if you like.
Yeah, please do.
Yeah, so this the survey actually was a little bit of an off and on endeavor off all of last year. It got delayed twice before it was able to move forward. But basically, it was assessing how students in the UW system felt about the state of free expression. And the reason that that was sort of called off so many times, there were procedural concerns, but possibly more relevant here, some faculty members felt that conservative lawmakers were going to use the results as fodder for budget cuts. They're very similar to what we're seeing here. The UW-Whitewater interim chancellor actually resigned over this whole thing last year. He said he felt like he and the other campus chancellors weren't allowed to give input on the survey, felt like it was being forced through. And so now that we do have the results, that has been a focus of attention for Republicans in the state. Dave Murphy, the chair of the Assembly Committee on Colleges and Universities, had a series of hearings this spring about the importance of free speech and intellectual diversity, citing a lot of those statistics that said conservative students do feel that's really nothing.
That is interesting. Thank you for sharing that with us. I'm curious about what's happening in Florida, because there's been a lot of talk about this. Governor Ron DeSantis signed two bills into law targeting these diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. It's all part of this ongoing effort to combat so-called critical race theory and gender ideology. That's according to the Chronicle of Higher Education's DEI legislation tracker. How is that going in Florida? How are universities being affected?
Well, the laws are supposed to go into effect July 1st, so we're going to see that happen very soon. But the thing is that a lot of people are very unclear about how this is actually going to look like in terms of implementation. Both faculty members and, you know, staff members of diversity-related offices in the state are really not sure what to do. They haven't received a lot of guidance from their administration or their department chairs. Many people are expecting there to be legal challenges in Texas as well as Florida. So there's a lot up in the air and a lot of uncertainty as that July 1st date approaches.
And let's talk a little bit more about Texas. Last month, Texas Republicans approved a ban on public colleges from having diversity offices or officers. I know that students and faculty in Texas have said they're afraid that these bills could, quote, destroy Texas colleges. How's that all going, and what do you see happening in the future there?
It's a very similar situation to what's going on in Florida. And I should mention that both states, there's also been recent legislative attacks on tenure, some of which have succeeded in one form or another, others have not. But this whole sort of atmosphere of DEI bills as well as tenure bills has contributed, I think many people in those states will tell you, to an overall sort of climate of uncertainty, feeling of hostility. Many faculty members in both of those states have opted to look elsewhere for jobs. Folks are maybe not applying to faculty or staff jobs in those states. And I think we're starting to see students as well, prospective students who say, a university in Texas or Florida is not for me right now.
We're talking about the push from Republicans against diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives in colleges in Wisconsin and beyond, states like Texas, states like Florida. With Megan Zaney, she's a senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Still plenty of time to take calls, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. I'm curious about what's happening in those offices, those DEI program offices in the state. UW System President Jay Rothman is defending these programs, but a lot of the college leaders across the country have been silent on these attacks. Why do you think college leaders have kind of stepped back and they've not spoken out against this pushback?
You're right that they have been largely silent, and to the dismay of a lot of faculty members and staff members who wish that their university leaders would come out and make a strong stance in favor of DEI legislation or DEI work at their institutions. I think, you know, it's hard to speculate, of course, exactly why the leaders have remained silent, but you would guess that they're worried about sort of running afoul of the legislators, of, you know, getting into sort of bad relations with the people who are funding, in many cases, their public university systems. And also, I think a lack of clarity on exactly what the legislation would do. The wording of a lot of it is so vague as to be unclear as to how exactly it's going to affect them. So there's still uncertainty there as well.
Well, and how is it going to affect them? I mean, some of these universities have really, they've just hired these positions, you know, people to spearhead these programs. What happens to these positions? What happens to these people?
And in fact, the UW system just last week, a new chief diversity officer started. And so that's still very unclear. There are people across the country who are wondering, what's going to happen to my job? Will I be reassigned elsewhere? Will I lose my job entirely? Is my center or my institute going to have to close its doors? They're really not sure what's going to happen.
How do university students feel about anti-DEI laws? Do we know? What are students saying about this as a whole?
The majority of students that I've seen have been coming out against this legislation. We've seen a lot of people going to state houses, particularly in Florida and Texas, to protest, to testify, and to say, we don't want this legislation. We feel strongly about DEI efforts at our institution, and we don't want those to go away. And as I said, some prospective students maybe are starting to look elsewhere, feeling that those states are not going to be the most hospitable environment for them, given their identities or given the kind of academic work they want to do.
What do you think is going to happen in the future? I mean, do you think that we're going to see more anti-DEI laws, or is this going to kind of, are the winds of change coming again?
It's hard to say. And right now, because we're coming in the summer, a lot of the legislative sessions in most states have wrapped up. So I'm not expecting there to be any new DEI bills coming forth in the immediate future, but certainly there are a lot of questions about, I think we'll see, based on Texas and Florida, maybe what will come for more states. There are states like Ohio that are still very much debating this. It's an open question as to what the specifics of the legislation are going to look like. And of course, in Wisconsin, we still don't know what the state budget committees can decide in the next few days.
Why do you think it is that education has been itself? I mean, we've heard so much controversy in the last couple of years about education, period. Everything from critical race theory to now DEI. Why is education such a central part of this national conversation?
I think it's because of the role that education plays in society, right? I mean, this is how people sort of form their belief systems through the things that they're taught, through the extracurricular, extramural activities that they're exposed to in school or in college. And so, you know, education has such a way of informing future citizens, current citizens. And I think that that's probably why we're seeing it as the front in this sort of war of ideology.
So you've got this education tracker, the DEI tracker on the Chronicle of Higher Education. Where can people find that? And is it constantly being updated?
It is. We update it every week, and it's on our website, which is chronicle.com.
We have about 30 seconds left in our time together, and I just wanted to mention Chris from Wausau called in, couldn't stay with us, but said that the UW Free Speech Survey isn't really representative of thoughts from a significant portion of the student body. Chris said students who aren't Republican opted not to take the survey. Did you hear that?
There was some conversation about that, yes. Folks who were opposed to the survey opted to boycott it, opted not to participate. And so there was some concern about the response rate. It was higher than in other states that had done similar surveys. But again, you you wonder always, I think, with the survey on a topic like this, how representative is it of everybody's opinions?
I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. Megan Zaney is a senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. She writes about research, universities, and workplace issues. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward, in for Kate Archer-Kent. Calls to weaken intellectual property rights for universities and nonprofits that rely on federal funding are raising some alarm bells. Advocates say making that kind of a change could threaten the country's economic competitiveness and perhaps our national security. What would happen if the government ultimately changes the status quo? Call in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Eric Iverson is the CEO of the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, known as WARF. Eric, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Shereen. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. How does the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation work? How does it support discovery?
It supports discovery by, we are the what's called the patenting organization or the technology transfer office for the University of Wisconsin at Madison. And as inventions arise on campus, they come to us and we evaluate whether we can seek patents on those. And if we can, we will file patents. And then it is our job to put those into the hands of people who can translate that into products and out into the world.
The Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation was established a long time ago, in 1925. It was the nation's first technology transfer office at a university. How did the foundation come about? Give me a little history here.
Thank you for the question. Quite a remarkable and altruistic move. Dr. Steenbach developed the invention of irradiating foods to enrich it with vitamin D, which was needed to address a disease called rickets, which is a terrible disease. And in the process, what he did is he turned to the university and said, hey, take this invention and seek a patent on it. And let's see if we can commercialize it with the food industry. The university was in no position to do that, kind of didn't know what it was doing, and it refused the idea. And Dr. Steenbach pulled together some cronies, and they formed the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, otherwise known as WARF. We filed a patent on that, and in 1925, we licensed that to Quaker Oats for $1 million.
In 1925, $1 million, that's a lot of money in 1925.
Ton of money. You're absolutely right. And he didn't take anything for that. I mean, that is effectively what he did, is he donated this remarkable invention that really addressed this scourge of a disease for this amount of money. And the other idea is we take those dollars then and we make grant back to the university to continue the research on campus. So it was really an amazing story.
Wow. We're talking about the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation with WARF CEO Eric Iverson. So share some examples of patented technology created by UW-Madison. Obviously, this, you know, this ultraviolet light irradiation technique is really important, too. What other things are we talking about here?
Well, the campus is remarkable. It has been incredibly broad. It's one of the broadest campuses, I suggest, in the entire world, running from the agriculture to the life sciences, engineering, of course, computer sciences. And so you never know on any given day what invention is going to come up, whether it's going to be a healthcare invention or something to help animals or a new crop variety or what have you. And so in any given year, 400 inventions show up at WARF, and we wind up filing patents on about half of those. And I, as I came out of Seattle, I thought, geez, I can't wait to see a lot of the imaging technologies and as we get into quantum and new motor technologies. And the first time I attended one of our invention disclosure meetings, it was all about new crop varieties, particularly beets and different colors and tastes. And I thought, wow, beets, really? I've moved from Seattle to talk about beets and cranberries. Exactly, beets and cranberries. And it is incredibly important to our economy here in Wisconsin and incredibly important for the country and, quite frankly, the world. And the beets, I said, well, what are we going to do with those? Well, Cordon Bleu and other international cooking schools look to Wisconsin for certainly the dairy area, but also new crops that we produce. So it runs the gamut, Shireen.
Wow. Well, I want to talk a little bit about the Bayh-Dole Act. This was passed in 1980. It allows universities and other nonprofit research labs to retain intellectual property rights to those technologies that they develop with the help of taxpayer funds. How did the Bayh-Dole Act impact the foundation's research?
Well, it allowed prior to the Bayh-Dole Act, which was around 1980 or so, mm-hmm. before that, the federal government owned all inventions that had some federal funding behind it. And although thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of new inventions were arising around the country, the federal government only licensed less than 5% of those. It just is not in a capacity to do anything with those inventions. So what Bayh-Dole allowed the universities to do is own the inventions that arise on their campus. And the campuses then across our country, and quite frankly, across the world, have tech transfer offices who take the inventions, put them in the hands of companies to develop products, whether it's for the environment or for health or animal welfare, new crops, et cetera. And as we do that, we receive license fees from the companies. And those license fees go into our investment portfolio, and we make big grants back to the campus each year. WRF is distinct because we're separate from the campus. We don't report up to the chancellor. We're not state employees. So we have a balance sheet and we make large grants. We provide to the campus upwards of $100 million a year in grant dollars to support the research enterprise. And that is just a fraction, of course, of the $1.3 to $1.5 billion a year this campus generates in research funding. But that's how we do it. We supplement a lot of research grants to campus.
Well, some lawmakers want the Biden administration to expand the Bayh-Dole. They want to improve access to cancer medication and lower its cost. How would it work?
Well, I don't think it should work through the Bayh-Dole Act, to be honest. My life has been spent largely on access to medicines. I worked for years with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. I was an early employee there. And I was hired specifically to address the issue of as the Gates said, we're spending billions on developing of vaccines, drugs, diagnostics, new crops even. How do we get those into the hands of the people we care about at the Gates Foundation, the poorest of the poor in the world? And regularly there is attacks on the patents saying, geez, if only there weren't patents, things would be cheaper and we could get them to the people we care about. Mm-hmm. And I traipse around the world doing a lot of stuff with the World Health Organization and developing countries. And I fundamentally do not believe that that is the root problem. It is really about how one manages patents and works with a partner to get a product developed. And so what we're hearing now is that issue has come home to roost in the United States, saying, well, geez, these patents on these drugs mean that these drugs are too expensive. Mm-hmm. And that's just too easy. That's too easy of a soundbite. And I think it is one issue of many that's driving our incredibly too high healthcare system. And drugs are too expensive. I agree with that. Mm-hmm. But it is not the patent situation is not a panacea to end that problem, nor is it really a critical problem, in my opinion.
How do you fix that then? I mean, that's probably the $10 million question, right?
You're absolutely right, Shireen. And it, you know, if we knew a quick answer to that problem, we would have done it already, right? Or at least I hope our policymakers would have done it already. And it's a broad set of issues that, of course, people in Washington, D.C. and people within our own legislature are grappling with all the time. But it is an incredibly complex series of issues. Government certainly has a role. Industry has a significant role. Funding institutions and the insurance industry, they do. That would take us many hours in a radio show, not just a brief one focus on patents.
Well, in March, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Department of Commerce announced this joint effort to review its authority under Bayh-Dole. What do you think is going to happen there?
Well, I think people will look at it and debate it. And I think Bayh-Dole itself, it's interesting. They're kind of mucking in an area trying to squeeze in a component that is, hey, if we don't like the price of a drug, we're going to go in what's called merchant rights, and we're going to take rights to those drugs. We're going to have them made elsewhere, and we're going to make them cheaper. That was fundamentally not an aspect of why Bayh-Dole was created. In fact, it was very much not about that, and the legislative history speaks to that. And periodically, these debates arise. And right now, it's a period of time with this administration. They're looking for ways, and quite frankly, quick ways, which I don't disagree with, I suppose, to address drug pricing. And patents always seem to be an easy target because they're tangible. One wants to go at this. But I think fundamentally breaking down Bayh-Dole Act, which has been enormously successful for this country in trillions of dollars of GDP, hundreds of thousands of jobs, tens of thousands of startup companies. I think trying to get a quick win on a drug pricing issue, attacking a law that has been so fundamentally transformative for our country is just too narrow-minded, in my opinion.
Something that you said just caught my attention. You said march-in rights. Can you explain what that is exactly?
Sure. Yeah, I appreciate the question. The Bayh-Dole Act is effectively says universities, if you give rise to an invention and has some federal funding, any federal funding on it, the university can own it. You can seek a patent on it, but it's your job to put it in the hands of companies or whomever to get it into the marketplace. And if the people who you've licensed the patents to do not, for commercial reasons, just don't get it into the marketplace, and the country feels it needs it for national security or other reason, it can march in and take the rights to put them into somebody else's hands to try to get the product made for the welfare of our citizenry. And what people like to say is, well, geez, that must mean that if the companies aren't making it as broadly available and as cheaply, then maybe the government can march in under that Bayh-Dole Act and take those products and make it more available cheaper. And that's too narrow of a reading, and it specifically wasn't designed for that. The government set this law into motion so that these inventions can be put into the hands of companies. It's about driving industry. It's about driving jobs. It's about driving products into the marketplace. It has nothing to do with the pricing of those products. It's just they want to make sure those products get to the marketplace one way or another.
Eric Iverson is the CEO of the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation. He stays with us. You can call in, too, with your questions and thoughts. 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward. We continue now our discussion on how universities and other nonprofit research labs retain intellectual property rights for the technologies they develop. Eric Iverson is the CEO of the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation. Call in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. You talked a little bit about how the system changed when Bayh-Dole happened. What do you think would happen if the federal government once again owned all the patents resulting from the research it funded?
Oh, I would think that we would go back to the pre-Bayh-Dole, right? I mean, that's your point.
Yeah.
And I think the federal government, having the federal government be the repository of thousands of inventions, the infrastructure that would have to be created at the federal government to do this kind of job, understanding the various technologies as well as the geographies, I think things would just go back to the way they were Prebydol. It's all been disseminated out to the individual universities who know their technologies best, and it also creates a much larger workforce to address these things. So it wouldn't be the right answer. I think no. It would bring the screeching halt to things.
So you don't think that the federal government now would be any more able to take this on than they were, you know, 40 plus years ago?
Well, they have their own technology transfer office already for internal research that they conduct within the federal labs. So they have their hands full already doing their own research and inventions. So, yeah, I think we'd just be compounding that on that in a very dramatic fashion. I think they're best placed within the universities in which the inventions arise, for sure.
And federal grants help pay for research. So if a technology is made possible by taxpayer funding, should the public have paid access to the end product? That's a question for you.
Yeah, and that is kind of the question, right? And that's mm-hmm. what people pose. And it's and I understand and I can appreciate very much that point. A lot of the inventions, however, are nascent when we receive them. They're ideas, they're hatched. And sure, there might be a researcher who has been in the lab and she's been working on something for years and perhaps even received millions of dollars of federal money. But once that invention gets put into the hands, for example, the drugs, because we were talking about drugs earlier, by the time a company, maybe it goes through a startup and you get venture funding and then you get a big pharma that gets into it, the federal government money might be a few million dollars that went into that very early. But by the time that drug gets to market, it's $400 or $500 million worth of expense. And in order to justify those expenses, whether to the venture community or to industry generally, there better be a market to give you a return. And so to have the government step in and suppress the price, it would really stifle innovation, particularly. It wouldn't stifle, I don't think, the research on campus, but it would stifle which products would get picked up, invested in, and taken to market, because you would be unsure if what kind of return you'd be able to get.
So fewer products would make it through.
I think definitely. For those products that the government would step in and require, for example, generics, yes, for sure. It would definitely suppress. In fact, we go through that analysis ourselves already. I mean, if a new drug comes in, or it's not new drugs, it's a new idea for a drug comes in, we evaluate whether the market is big enough to warrant the kind of expense that we, not to mention people we hand it to, are going to be able to take it to market. And if they can't, then we're never going to find the investments to do it. So that evaluation goes on already. To compound that problem pretty dramatically by suppressed prices by the U.S. government would have a real deleterious effect on translational into new products, you bet.
We're talking.
I apologize. My dog suddenly decided to chew on a bone next to me.
Hey, that's okay. That's okay. He can be part of the show. So we're talking about the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation with WARF CEO Eric Iverson and Eric's dog. The Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation grants millions of dollars annually to UW-Madison to recruit and retain research faculty and grad students. Talk a little bit about how that research funding benefits the state's economy as a whole.
Thanks, Shereen. It is quite remarkable. Just looking at statistics that the campus has put up, almost $31 billion of related startup economic impact on the state. You're talking 92% economic impact benefits the private sector. For every dollar of state funds invested in this fantastic campus, just this campus, not all of the UW system, by the way, $26 returns to the state. So you do that math, and it's just really quite astounding. Billions of dollars in taxes generated, 232,000 jobs supported, 400 plus startup companies. So the economic, as an engine for this economy, it is really quite astounding. I'm very proud to be associated with it, for sure.
Do other states and other universities and states have the same kind of setup, or is Wisconsin unique here?
Many of the states. I mean, of course, we can look at the big research institutions, particularly in the Big Ten, of course. But the economies that truly thrive have to have a big research university embedded within them. It just, you look across from Boston to the Bay Area, to San Diego, Seattle, New York, it's, and then throughout the country, whether it's Austin with UT, University of Texas, or Boulder, of course, with Colorado. And that's in part why Madison, I think in large part why Madison thrives, because of the campus that's here. So in an economy, in a thriving one, and it goes well beyond the city, but into geographic, larger geographic regions, they need a big research enterprise to produce these inventions and new ideas.
And where does Wisconsin sit? You know, I mean, how do we compare really to other states? Are we in a leadership role here, or do we have a long way to go?
Well, we're a leader. Wisconsin, as we like to say, punches way above its weight, in the sense of here we sit and in a relatively low population state with this massive university, and we rank currently eighth. I hopefully will jump in those rankings, but of research institutions in the country, we're eighth in total research expenditures at about 1.3 to 1.5 billion. 1.3 was a recent rankings, but I've heard recently that we're as high as 1.5 billion in research dollars spent in a year. It's just astounding how much money goes through this place and the research. And I can attest that it is productive research, because an invention by definition is brand new, right? Brand new. Nobody's thought of this idea before. And we get 400 of those inventions a year from this campus. So the output is phenomenal. And you think about, to the extent we can put even a small fraction of that to work in this state, the jobs, the products, the businesses it supports is quite astounding. We should all be proud. Deeply proud of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and quite frankly, proud of our entire UW system.
Just briefly, we only have about 30 seconds left together, but how do you sift through 400 inventions a year and choose what works and what doesn't?
Well, it's not about what, thank you for the question. It's not about what works and what doesn't. It's about what the patent law says is patentable. And so there may not be sufficient data associated with it. It may not truly be novel. You know, the various rules that you have to comply with for something to be patentable. But it's, we have a team of PhDs and super smart people on staff that then work with the faculty to make those decisions on a monthly basis. It's quite a machine.
It must be. Well, Eric, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Shireen. I really appreciate you having me on.
You bet. Eric Iverson, the CEO of the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation. I'm Shireen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.